Hello, I'm John Hilton, editor at the Cochrane Editorial Unit. Welcome to the April 2011 roundup from the Cochrane Library. The latest issue of the Cochrane Library includes 22 new and 37 updated Cochrane reviews, as well as a new editorial and a special collection of reviews on post-traumatic stress disorder. In this roundup, we'll hear from the authors of updated reviews on behavioural interventions to prevent cervical cancer and incentives for promoting smoking cessation. Smoking cessation is also the subject of this month's Cochrane Library editorial by Paul Aveyard and Linda Bald from the UK Centre for Tobacco Control Studies. We talked to Linda Bald about the issues raised in the updated review. To read the updated reviews or the editorial, visit our homepage at thecochranelibrary.com. The new Evidence Aid collection on post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD, has been produced in response to the earthquake and tsunami that struck Japan on 11th of March 2011. For some people exposed to these types of traumatic event, the initial emotions of fear, anxiety, and distress can develop into PTSD. Although most people diagnosed with PTSD fully recover, a small proportion of people develop chronic PTSD a year after the event. This can cause long-term impairments affecting the individual, their family, and society. The Evidence Aid collection brings together the summary conclusions of Cochrane reviews on the effects of interventions aimed at preventing and treating PTSD, with links to the full reviews. This collection, along with our two existing Evidence Aid collections of resources for earthquakes and resources for flooding, have been translated into Japanese by the Kyoto University School of Public Health. This Japanese translation can be accessed via evidenceaid.org. In discussions of how to reduce the incidence of cervical cancer, strategies aimed at encouraging sexual behaviours intended to prevent it tend to be overlooked. A newly updated Cochrane review examines the evidence for these sorts of interventions. Lead author Jonathan Shepherd from the Southampton Health Technology Assessment Centre in England describes the findings.
Invasive cervical cancer is one of the most common cancers worldwide, causing considerable morbidity and mortality. Many people think of screening programs or human papillomas virus vaccination as the means for preventing it, and although these are important strategies, primary prevention through sexual risk reduction behaviours may also have a role. Young women are at high risk of sexually transmitted infections, or STIs, including the types of human papillomavirus that cause cervical cancer. Our Cochrane Review identifies the types of behavioural strategy that have been tested and assesses their effectiveness. We found mixed results, with benefits for some of the interventions tested. Our definition of a behavioural intervention was fairly broad. At its most basic, such interventions can provide information about the transmission and prevention of STIs and the promotion of sexual health in general. This might be accompanied by additional components, such as skills development for safer sexual practices, for example, effective communication with partners, counselling and provision of resources, such as free condoms, and services, for example, STI testing or immunisation, as well as changes in policy and legislation. We included 23 randomised trials among women up to 25 years of age. The behavioural interventions generally provided factual information about sexual and reproductive health, as well as teaching the women skills such as assertiveness, sexual negotiation, and correct condom use. A handful of trials supplemented this with provision of resources, including vouchers redeemable for sexual health treatment services. Some took place in a single session, lasting less than a day, whilst others were spread out over weeks or months. Most were delivered in healthcare settings, notably sexual health and family planning clinics. Our results present a mixed picture, and the variety of interventions meant that meta-analysis was not appropriate. It was common for the trials to report statistically significant effects for behavioural outcomes, but this was not universal and varied according to the different types of outcome. Condom use for vaginal intercourse was the most widely reported behavioural outcome measure, and many studies showed a significant effect, notably on measures such as decreasing the number of episodes of unprotected intercourse or increasing the number of episodes of protected intercourse. Few significant effects were reported for encouraging consistent condom use. Few trials measured changes in sexual activity, such as how many of the young women engaged in sex or reduced their number of sexual episodes, or became sexually abstinent, and results were not conclusive. The impact on STI rates was measured in about half of the trials, but most of these were not large enough to detect a significant effect, so we cannot be sure whether or not behavioural interventions can prevent infections. Two trials which had favourable results and were judged to be at the least risk of bias are worth noting in particular. Their interventions were designed to be culturally and gender relevant to young African American women engaging in STI risk behaviour who were attending sexual health clinics. They were given information on STIs, skills development for effective partner communication, and negotiation of consistent condom use. This was delivered by African American peer and other educators in a small group format over 2 to 4 weeks with follow-up phone calls over 9 months. Practitioners considering replicating these interventions should consider applicability to their localities and adapt them as necessary to ensure social, demographic, and cultural relevance. Our latest results are broadly as expected and are similar to those from other reviews. The effects were generally investigated in the short term, with women in the trials being followed up between 6 and 12 months after the intervention. Therefore, it may be the case that, given adequate time, young women learn to adopt safer sexual behaviours and make these routine in their lives. Conversely, we don't know whether these behaviours, once learned, are maintained in years to come. Future studies should evaluate interventions over longer time periods, using booster interventions as necessary. In general, trials of behavioural interventions to prevent STIs tend to focus on short-term implications of infection, giving less consideration to longer-term outcomes such as pelvic inflammatory disease, infertility, and cervical cancer. Greater awareness of human papillomavirus, its link to cervical cancer, and the importance of sexual risk reduction should be encouraged and should be used in combination with human papillomavirus vaccination programs.
The full review, including details of the behavioural interventions that Jonathan and his colleagues reviewed, is on thecochranelibrary.com. The Cochrane Library also contains a strong collection of reviews from the Cochrane Tobacco Addiction Group on interventions to help smokers quit. Kate Cahill at the University of Oxford in England describes an updated review on the effects of competitions and incentives.
Competitions and incentives have been used in many smoking cessation programs to encourage recruitment into the program or to reward smoking cessation. There has recently been a growing enthusiasm in the UK for incentive-based programs to try and change unhealthy behaviours. For example, in 2007, the Tayside area of Scotland launched an incentive scheme for pregnant smokers called Give It Up for Baby, in which grocery vouchers worth £12.50 a week could be won for verified abstinence. Early reports confirm that 140 women stopped smoking in the first year of the programme, but the long-term value of such initiatives, especially once the rewards are withdrawn, remains to be determined. Our review asked two basic questions. Firstly, do competitions and incentives help smokers to quit in the long term? And secondly, can incentives improve recruitment into smoking cessation programmes? 19 studies met our inclusion criteria involving more than 4,500 smokers. All of the studies rewarded those who managed to quit, and some also rewarded smokers for signing up to the program and for the extent of their participation in it. Most of the studies were run in work sites, but 7 were set in clinics or health centers. There was a lot of variety in the incentives tested. For example, 2 studies used lottery tickets and 7 used cash payments. 3 studies combined cash rewards with prize draws across the worksite, and 2 studies rewarded individuals with cash payments proportionate to their team's performance within a worksite. All but 2 of the studies offered some kind of cessation support over and above the incentive scheme. This support included counselling, nicotine replacement therapy, or self-help materials. Only one study, the largest of those we included, showed a clear benefit for the incentive group over the control group beyond the six-month assessment point. This trial referred its participants to local smoking cessation services and offered large cash rewards of up to $750 for those who took part in a smoking cessation program and also managed to quit. The remaining studies in our review did not show a lasting benefit of incentives for quitting. They appeared to improve compliance while they were in place, but when they were withdrawn, the normal pattern of relapse was likely to re-establish itself. Something that might be more promising is the effect of incentives on recruitment. Even if the long-term quit rate is not improved by rewarding the successful quitters, boosting the absolute numbers of smokers recruited into cessation programs could still deliver higher absolute numbers of quitters. This may be the real potential of a reward system for smoking cessation. In other words, rewarding smokers for taking part rather than for quitting. Interpreting the findings of all these studies remains problematic, partly because of the difficulties faced by researchers in measuring smoking cessation. In an ideal world, all the participants would be tested biochemically at the start of the study to ensure that they are current smokers, and those claiming to have quit at the end of the study would also be tested to ensure that they are truly abstinent. This is usually not feasible, and it remains an intractable weakness of many of the studies. Although most of the studies in our review reported adequate agreement between claims of abstinence and biochemical verification of those claims, some showed clear disparities. One study of smokers with schizophrenia found major differences between quit claims validated by breath samples, which confirm abstinence for a few hours, and those validated by urine samples, confirming a few days of abstinence. This doesn't necessarily indicate deception, but it does suggest that the abstinence for which the rewards were being claimed was not well established or long lasting. Two further studies, set in work sites, had sprung the biochemical test on their quitters at follow-up, and they found mismatches for a quarter to a third of them. This could mean that people using a postal questionnaire or a phone call to answer a question about their smoking may be more likely to say what they think the questioner wants to hear if they are not expecting a separate check on the truthfulness of their answer.
Kate's review is discussed in an accompanying editorial on the Cochrane Library. Editorial author Linda Bald spoke to us about some of the issues raised in the review and the use of incentives in other areas of public health.
In their newly updated Cochrane review, Kate Cahill and Rafael Pereira summarised the effects of incentives for smoking cessation, concluding that while there is some evidence that incentives work in the short term, the effects generally dissipate, and they conclude that there is still insufficient evidence to recommend their adoption into routine practice. So I'd like to delve a little deeper into the particular question that this review highlights. So we know that behaviour change can be simple, that's single actions at a point in time, or complex, requiring effort over a sustained period. An example of simple behaviour change is adherence to medication. A systematic review in the BMJ in 1997 assessed financial incentives to motivate adherence to medical instruction. The incentives ranged from $5 to $1,000, and 10 of the 11 studies found a positive effect. The studies incentivized several types of intervention, and those included immunization, engaging with antihypertensive treatment, attending postpartum appointments, completing cocaine dependency treatment, and also dental care for children. Complex behaviour change, on the other hand, requires both sustained effort and typically the adoption of multiple strategies to achieve change. An example is weight loss to reduce obesity. A 2007 systematic review of incentives for weight loss found that larger incentives seemed more effective and that the effectiveness seemed to decline when the incentive was withdrawn. So that's a similar finding to the smoking cessation incentives review. So overall then, should we conclude that incentives are effective for simple behaviour changes, but not for complex behaviour change? Well, that might seem at odds with the evidence for the efficacy of incentives for managing drug misuse, particularly problem drug use. So ceasing to use illicit drugs requires complex behavioural change, but some actions are simple. For example, deciding to engage in a treatment program or attending for a supervised dispensing of methadone, for example, those are simple behaviors. And these are among the set of behaviors that have been effectively rewarded in studies of incentives in drug misuse. So we've got good evidence there. While most smokers regret starting smoking and want to stop, only a minority take action and try to quit. So other Cochrane reviews testify to the effectiveness of both behavioral support for smoking cessation and medication in enhancing cessation. But these interventions are infrequently used by people attempting to quit, particularly in combination. So in the United Kingdom, to use just one example, we have a national network, or there is a national network, of free cessation clinics dispensing reimbursed medication to support smoking cessation. And their availability is advertised, and it's also promoted by healthcare professionals in the UK. But despite this, these clinics are used by fewer than 10% of quitters. Now, simple behavior change may be sufficient to increase the proportion of smokers who attempt to stop or who use aids to help them quit, either of which will increase the number of long-term abstainers. Even interventions of marginal effectiveness in smoking cessation can be cost-effective because the benefits of smoking cessation are just so great. So overall, then, we've seen the potential value of incentives. They seem to work sometimes for some smokers. Understanding how they work, whether the benefits are sustained, and that their effects are not due to gaming the system remains a public health priority. And it's worthy of further randomized trials and further updates of the Cochrane Review.
You can read the editorial and related reviews on thecochranelibrary.com. Thank you for listening to this monthly roundup of what's new on the Cochrane Library.